This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And today, it's a very special hour. I'm not going to stop for any commercials because I have a guest. I want him on the program for every minute I can get him. Peter Riva is a man who wears many hats. He is an award-winning author. He is a literary agent, and he is the grandson of one of my favorite Hollywood stars, Marlena Dietrich. And I'm so happy to welcome him back to Joy on Paper. He's been here before. And one of the things that I have to tell him is that during the pandemic, one of his books really kept me going. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Patsy. How are you?
Okay, I'm fine. And I am so happy to have you back on the program because I really wanted to tell you how very, very much your book called A Tribal Rumble, A Safari Campfire Tale, just kept me going through the pandemic. The Audible version. Now, of course, I had read the wonderful book itself because, you know, I need to read the book. But when I got the Audible version, I tell you, Peter, it's fantastic.
He did such a good job, the narrator. He really did. And I was quite amazed at how his voice resonated with the tone of the story. It was excellent.
Oh, he captured the story, and it is such a beautiful story. And I often tell my listeners about it and tell them they have to listen to it because it really will change you in so many ways. And the story is fascinating. We'll talk about that. We're going to talk about all your hats. I mean, you wear a lot of hats.
I do.
I know you're a busy guy, but I thought what we do, let's talk first, put on your literary agent hat, and we'll talk about that. Then I want to talk about you as an author and about your wonderful books, and I know that you have a contract for two more of this wonderful series that I love. So, and then I couldn't have you on without talking to you about your grandmother, who means so much in my life, too. So let's start with a literary agent.
Well, it's been a busy time. You know, COVID really did shake up the publishing world. Everybody suddenly found out that they could be as effective working from home. And I think there's going to be a lot of office space empty in Manhattan in the coming years. I found that people really got reengaged with reading, which was a wonderful thing. Book sales, both electronic books, audiobooks, as well as print books, remained consistently strong all the way through COVID, which is to be expected, but everybody thought they'd fall off after COVID ended, and they haven't, which is great. I think a lot of people have rediscovered the joy of reading. And the joy for me particularly was that the books that are doing the best in the marketplace in this last year have not been political. And I think a lot of people are getting reconnected with the truths that can be in fiction and also, of course, nonfiction. And it's just a joy to discover the world that you can through books.
Well, you as a literary agent, you get this wonderful opportunity to help authors on the path, which is, you know, here on Joy on Paper, I always encourage people to write, and I was so happy when during the pandemic and in last November, so many of my listeners did NaNoWriMo, National Novel Writing Month, and five of them finished their books. And now, you know, they've of course, after the holidays, after the first of the year, they come back to their 50,000 words that they wrote during November, which is something, you know, really, it's something to be very proud of. But now,
oh, absolutely.
Now they have to understand there's another job that comes next. It's called editing, and then hopefully finding a literary agent. So,
well, remember what Hemingway said: writing is rewriting. I don't think Hemingway ever did less than 12 or 15 different versions of his work until he decided it was good enough to share with people, and that's. That is the, you know, I hate to say it's not a chore. It's such a joy to go back over what you've written and look at it again and again and again. And I always encourage our authors, no matter how accomplished they are, to, when they finish the manuscript and they say, okay, Peter, this is ready to go, I say, well, sit on it for 2 weeks, then read it out loud. Because a lot of people forget that the way words play in our head has a certain rhythm, a cadence. And if you can't read your work out loud, it means the reader is not going to have that flow of words in their head. And that communication, that generosity between author and reader, is really critical. So it's such a fun thing to go back and read your own words out loud, even if you're only reading it out loud to an empty room. But if you read it out loud, then you can see, oh, that's not working, that sentence is a little long, or this bit short, I have to put in another syllable here. You can adjust your work to be its best possible for the next person who's going to have access. And that's long before you consider trying to find a literary agent. And when Patsy, because I know a lot of your people are going to want to know, well, how do we find a literary agent and all the rest? The first thing you've got to do is decide which other authors in your local bookstore fit the genre, fit the taste of the reader that you want to attract. So if you're writing a thriller or a World War II novel or whatever it may be, go to the local bookstore and look at books that you think, yes, this writer is it tackling the same area that I'd like to talk about, or the same morals that I'm talking about, or the same page-turning excitement? Whatever it is that links you to other authors who are in the marketplace, make a note of those publishers and the title of the book and the author, and then you go to a site which I use a lot called Publishers Marketplace, and you look for who was the editor of those books. And then you can contact that editor directly. Also, it'll tell you who the agent was on those books, and you can contact those agents as well, so that you're trying to appeal your work to a receptive audience.
Exactly. You know, this is what I've been telling the ones who finished the NaNoWriMo. I said, you know, the editing process is actually, it's so much fun. If you have to face it, you know, that with a smile, because you have this opportunity, you're creating something and playing with words and moving them around and just getting that right feel. It is such an exciting part of being a writer.
Yeah, I kind of liken it to, you know, parents of the first baby, and they look at the baby and they're thrilled to death with it. And then how much time do those parents spend finding just the right clothing or just the right booties or just the right hat? It's that fine tuning you need to do. You're not throwing your novel out. You're not saying, oh, I have to redo it. What you're saying is, how can I make this better? How can I make this more the way I want it to be? And it's like dressing your baby. You're going to buy the clothes you like, and you're going to dress the baby up to be as pretty as you can make that baby to be. So do the same thing for your work and treat it with that same love and respect for the work that you put in already, and it'll be more acceptable to the next people who get to see it.
Now, as a literary agent, of course, you get, how many submissions do you get a week?
I'm trying to cut it down. I've been putting warnings to people that we're not really looking, so I'm only getting about 6 a week now.
Oh, that's all. Okay. So nowadays, of course, they come electronically, we get them in emails,
right.
Not like the old days where you used to get the whole manuscript.
I still get that occasionally, Patsy, and that's always a little disturbing, because that's, you know, people send me something that's 3 pounds in weight and they've put their heart and soul into it, and you don't want to just reject it. But you know, the problem I have, and frankly, the problem all literary agents have, is that we've been made the gatekeepers, and we don't really want to be the gatekeepers. We want to be the person, like the basketball coach, who makes your play better. But instead of which, they're saying the team can't even get on the field unless the coach says they're fit. So we have to look at these works that are submitted to us in the same series of criteria that the publisher is going to look at them. And the publishers realize that in America, the first 10 pages of any novel, particularly, has to be true to the voice of the author, has to be true to the characters, and has to give a good idea of what's to come. And it's an unfortunate fact that that criteria is governed by the book buyers. And here's the thing that authors don't know. No book is ever bought by the person who's reading it. Books are bought by publishers who then sell them to book buyers. Book buyers, for instance, the book buyers at Barnes & Noble, they get somewhere between 250 and 350,000 submissions a year. They don't have time to read these books. So the criteria everybody has set is, we'll read the first 10 pages. If the two-paragraph blurb on the book is exciting enough, we'll read the first 10 pages and make a decision on what we're buying. That's why I say to my authors, be very sure that the first 10 pages of your whatever work it is, whether it's narrative nonfiction or fiction, make sure that it will appeal consistently throughout the whole book and that it sets in place the tone, voice, speed, pace, characterization of your work. And one other thing I want to point out here. Dialogue should never be used to advance the plot. Dialogue should be reinforcement of characterization. And people who put dialogue in the first few pages, thinking that the reader is going to understand the character of the person, they won't. Because until you have given us a full description of who the proponents are, if I read dialogue, my brain will make up an image of who I think is speaking and how they're speaking. And later on in the book, I may find out that that description was wrong, and then I stop believing the voice of the narrator. So it's always better to establish in the reader's mind who the characters are before you start having them speak.
Now, when you're getting these emails nowadays, that subject line, what does that do for you? Do people write
the subject line is never
a submission, or
yeah, no, yeah, the subject line. Well, you know, I always suggest to authors that what they do is write a. Remember that most literary agents are not 18-year-olds, so therefore, write to a literary agent as you would your parent. And in the subject line, say, I would like to make a submission to you. I have a novel. And then in the text, you say, here's a brief description of what I've written. May I make this submission to you? And you can include there a little bit about who you are. You know, I'm a graduate from Yale University, whatever it may be. And that way, you're soliciting the time of the literary agent to consider accepting your submission. Well-written appeals like that invariably will get you a response of, sure, send it along, and here are our criteria that we need. And each literary agency has criteria that they require from the author. I have a list of 10 things that I send authors. I need all this information if you want me to look at your proposal properly. And that helps the author know, okay, that's what I'm going to be putting together, my biography, what are called comps, books that are in the same genre of mine, how many words my novel is, or nonfiction, is it complete or not complete, how many, you know, and so on and so forth. There's a series of criteria so that we can evaluate the proposal properly and go from there. And, you know, it's a step process. You don't want to assume. And the other thing is, authors really have to remember that they're asking a literary agent to become, in essence, a partner. They're not hiring a literary agent. A literary agent doesn't make any money, hopefully, doesn't charge money, as we don't. A literary agent doesn't make any money until the book actually makes money. So consequently, you're asking somebody to put their time, their effort, their expertise, and their entree into the business at your disposal for the project that you're proposing. So it's as well to remember, if you're an author, that you're not looking to hire a literary agent. You're asking a literary agent to partner up with you on your project.
So now with you, what's new with you? What are the books, the authors that you're dealing with right now?
Well, Mary Glickman is without a doubt one of America's finest authors. She broke through about 10 years ago, and her books consistently sell well. She has a series of wonderful, wonderful novels. I'll give you briefly the titles here. There's Home in the Morning, which was an award winner, Marching to Zion, One More River, and Undisturbed Peace. And she has a new book out that just launched recently, and I'm hoping that you'll invite her to appear on your program because she's such a lovely lady. It's called By the Rivers of Babylon. And Mary has a particular feel for the South. She writes between Mississippi and Georgia, stories that go back to the 1800s all the way up to today. And she fits her stories in with characters who either repeat in the stories or relatives and generational repeat. And they're wonderful examinations of human fallibility and the civil rights issues, and also a lot of them are imbued with Jewish, I don't know the right word here, but all her novels deal with a lot of Jewish immigrants and the relatives of those Jewish immigrants who are still in the South doing business and finding that their understanding of the African-American troubles are something that they can deal with better than some of the other people that they come in contact with. And the protagonists in her book are, all of them are truly wonderful. And they're very exciting books, too.
So, this, I've often said, a literary agent can be worth their weight in gold because it is a difficult thing for authors nowadays to get through through all of the many, many, many submissions of and books that are, loaded up on Amazon every day. So the work of the agent, of how you get to a publisher, How does that work? What's your do you just call him up and say, I've got a great book? Or how do you go about doing that?
Well, Patsy, I'm an old guy, so I've been around at this job a long time. I mean, as we used to call them, Rolodex, my CRM database is 3,000 strong. So I have a system of drilling down to editors who are looking for works in the same genre, and then I call them up and talk to them and put a submission and proposal together, send it off, and then we talk again on the phone, and when they've read it, they come back with their feelings and their thoughts, and sometimes the better editors that I deal with will come back with, this author is wonderful, but the story has a problem here and here, and we go back to the author and explain that, and if they agree, they do a rewrite, and we resubmit it. It's a process. It's a process that we try and achieve some kind of cooperation with the right editor and the right house. My job has never been simply to find a publisher for works. My job is quite often involving finding the right editor who's going to enhance the book and enhance the author's possibilities.
And working with an author is something that, for new writers, it's a daunting task. There, sometimes authors don't like criticism, which I tell them, right from when they tell me, I finished the book, I want to send it to an editor. I say, well, you have to be tough. I mean, because they're going to be tough on you if they're a good editor.
Well, they should be. There was a wonderful story. Maya Angelou always used to tell this story about my favorite editor, Bob Loomis, who passed away a few years back. And when she first sent her first manuscript to Bob Loomis to read, 2 weeks later it came back to her in the mail, and she looked at the manuscript and she couldn't see any corrections or anything else, so she called up, and Bob says, "Well, no, I've made suggestions." And she said, "Well, I've looked at every page, and every once in a while there's a little squiggle in the margin." And he said, "Yes." And she said, "What do I do?" He said, "The squiggle is to tell you that something in that paragraph doesn't work." And so she used to swear at him, saying, "Well, you couldn't tell me what it was that doesn't work." And he said, "No, that's not my job. You're a brilliant writer. There's something in that paragraph that doesn't work. Go and find it." And in fact, all the books that he edited for her over the years were exactly the same way. And she was always very funny about his little squiggles in the margin. Now, other editors will go and slash and burn and make comments that are quite often hard to take. But the point of an editor is to highlight for the author those things that that editor thinks doesn't work, and it's up to the author to decide, yes, I agree or don't agree, but it's also meant in a constructive manner. Quite often, I have to tell you that we'll get some manuscripts, and the author has got a wonderful tale, and it's a strong story, and it's usually this is in the nonfiction area, but boy, the voice is wrong, and I will edit the first 20 pages and say, this is where you're going wrong. And I've had authors say to me, "Well, you know nothing, I'm going somewhere else." And then a year later, they come back to me and they say, "Okay, we reread it a year later, and you're absolutely right. Can we send it again?" It's just because we do this day in, day out. Editors do this day in, day out. They know what is going to work in the marketplace. And at the end of the day, authors have to realize that there is a difference between writing something for your own enjoyment that you want to share with people and writing something for your own enjoyment that you want to be shared commercially with people. The commercial aspect requires a different kind of gauntlet than just publishing something on your own. And you have to be willing to take the sometimes tough criticism, but always constructive criticism that editors offer.
Well, of course, for you, because you are also an author, and I noticed that you won an award for the book 3 in your series. It's just it's a wonderful series, and that's Kidnapped on Safari, which is your third book.
Right.
So
in that series, yeah.
It's a wonderful series. Now, you're going to be making more of these books, right?
Yes, I have another one coming out this year, later on this year in November, called Elephant Safari. And the same cast of characters go on a walking safari following elephants in northern Kenya into Ethiopia.
Well, as I said, Tribal Rumble is so wonderful. And tell us about Mbuno and in the series about Pero.
Well, Pero is a television and film producer, and he always brings a film crew to go and do something, and they hire Mbuno to go with them. Mbuno is a Walengulu ex-elephant hunter, and Mbuno is one of those people who's a man of the land. He is at one with nature and at one with the surroundings that he's in, no matter where he is, and he tends to evaluate the human animals as wild animals. So he'll say, "Well, this person is more like a lion, and this person's more like a warthog." And so he assesses them in a way that he can better deal with the humans that he has to come across. Mbuno is also, being a Walengulu guide, Mbuno was built on a gentleman I knew, fortunate to know, in the 80s, called Mbuno. And Mbuno, and he told me the tales of his father and himself. Mbuno, the actual real man, was a safari guide for Bill Holden and Hemingway and so on, and his father before him was a guy all the way back to Teddy Roosevelt. So it's a long history that his lineage had in dealing with animals in the wild. Mbuno had a lot of the Walyangulu traditional hunters. And bear in mind, by traditional hunters, it meant that they used to hunt with bow and arrow on foot elephant, and the only elephant they could get near was the old sterile male or female, and they never wasted any of the animal. It was for food and consumption, and it was hunting, pure hunting. It wasn't trophy hunting, and of course that's no longer allowed, which is probably the right thing, but Mbuno is a man of great honor, and they developed a method of imitating the stomach rumbling of elephants, which is the elephant's main method of communicating within the herd. And he was able to demonstrate that to me a few times. It's a very odd belching stomach rumble that he was able to do. And, of course, I weave that into my stories, that Mbuno in the books is able to a certain degree, communicate with elephants.
And, of course, in Tribal Rumble, he teaches Carol how to do it. And it's I love that scene. That's one of my favorite scenes.
It is. It's a lovely thing, because I have to be honest here and tell you that he tried to teach me, and I failed miserably. So I wanted somebody to be successful, and Carol was such a lovely character that I wanted her to be able to imitate his stomach rumbling. And it's a strange thing, because I went with Mbuno once. Daphne Sheldrick has an orphanage for baby elephants that are found after their parents were slaughtered, and she rescues these baby elephants. And Mbuno went there, and he started rumbling to the baby elephants, and they all started swaying in unison with him. And it was something remarkable to see that this very slight man, very thin man, was able to not talk to the elephants, but join the rhythm of the elephants, and they joined his. So it's truly a remarkable fact that stomach rumbling is hardly understood by people still to this day.
Well, it's beautiful the way you write about it, and where Carol becomes one with the elephants, and I love that. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful scene.
Well, you know, that the other thing in that scene, which was so much fun for me, was the bananas, because we were filming up near Mount Kenya, and Daphne Sheldrake, Jane Goodall, who rescues the chimpanzees, she has a refuge up there that she's built with wire around it and everything for chimpanzees rescued from war areas in Rwanda and so on. And she's rehabilitating the chimpanzees up there. And she, of course, planted bananas there for the chimps and has this wire fencing all the way around it. Well, the wire fencing on the outside row of fencing has this 18,000-volt high-tensile wire with telephone poles 12 feet high to stop the elephants breaking in. And the weird thing is, we filmed the elephants at night, because every night they would get in to eat bananas, because elephants are obsessed with bananas. And that's how I found out that elephants are crazy about bananas. So what the elephants would do is they would come up to the telegraph pole where there was these wires like 2 feet apart. They'd put their trunk in between the wires without touching the wires, and they'd rock the pole backwards and forwards till it cracked. Then they'd go to the next one and wait until it cracks. And by the time they cracked 8 or 9 of these telephone poles, the weight of the wire would fall on the floor, the wires would short out, the elephants would walk in, eat all the bananas. So we filmed this for it was a fun thing to film in the mid 90s, and it was hysterical, because you just couldn't keep the elephants away from bananas. So I put that in the story, and apparently Daphne Sheldrick, in her rescue of these baby mtotos, she buys bananas all the time, because that's the way to get them to follow you. Just have a banana and they'll follow you.
Well, you write about Africa so beautifully. How old were you when you made your first trip to Africa?
16, in 1966. And then the next time was in 81. And then I went back pretty much every year until 96.
Well, it's obviously a place that you love and that you it has part of your heart because you put that in your books.
It is. It's a remarkable place, and it's the last vestiges on this planet of the true wild. It's not a garden. It's not maintained. It has that connection to nature on every level that it's hard to find in our planet at the moment. And I would always encourage people to go to Africa and have that safari. It's a wonderful, wonderful experience.
Well, now that the pandemic's over and people can travel again, definitely it is something that, especially after reading your books, you get this feeling that you want to be part of it. You want to be there and see it for yourself.
That's so nice of you, Patsy. Thank you.
Well, I mean, that's what your books are very powerful. I think, there are a lot of books about Africa, but what I love about it, I think, of course, it's partly Mbuno, but then also Pero and the people around him and their the dignity that they have and the feeling that they have of wanting to do the right thing while they're in Africa.
I agree. Recently, a fellow wrote to me from California saying, I have a question for you. Is Pero an African-American or is he white? And I said, it doesn't make any damn difference. Why is the color of skin any different? He's just Pero.
Exactly. That's what...
You know, it's a strange thing that you... Wonderful reading the book, and yes, I do describe his character and the way he behaves and how he talks, and he's a resilient person who plans ahead and sees opportunities to make things better. And he's an intelligent person, but it's not important as to what his race is. What's important is his capability as a human. We're all humans at the end of the day. This nonsense of defining people by color has got to stop at some point.
It certainly does. And one of the things, I was hoping after the third book that streaming video would pick you up. I think this your stories, you know, because the series, they're really international thrillers about crimes, about things that are happening, and so there's a lot of thrill writing in these books that would make for wonderful, wonderful streaming video.
Yeah, I have a friend at the State Department after he read Kidnapped on Safari, and he said, that twist at the end, you don't realize how close you came to the reality. I said, listen, I'm a news junkie, and I caught wind of this possibility, and I thought I'd put it in the book. He says, yeah, well, it was a little too close to the mark, Peter.
Well, I thought so, too. That's why I said it's so timely, and I think it would make just a wonderful series.
Oh, thank you.
Something different. As much as I love Jane Austen and Charlotte Bronte, if they make one more Pride and Prejudice or one more Wuthering Heights, I'm going to go crazy.
I know.
This, you know, come on, there's original material and something unusual, something different. And I can tell you, this would be so wonderful. Have Mbuno. I'd love that scene. I think it would be terrific.
Patsy, between your mouth and God's ear. Thank you.
That's what they have to do. They need something original, and actually that would be filmed in the sunshine. That would be the nicest thing. They'd go to Africa and film in the sunshine, because if I see one more of these things that they shoot with in the dark, I don't understand why they don't understand lighting, unlike your grandmother who understood lighting.
Yeah, it is a little shocking sometimes, I have to agree. And the other thing that now is happening all the time, which drives me completely nuts, is they're using cell phones as part of the storytelling.
Oh, I hate
How
that.
Is it possible that anybody can read the text on a cell phone from unless you're 2 feet away?
Oh, I hate that. I hate it. I hate it. I just, you know, You know, I wrote some scripts, you know, when I was in Hollywood, and I had three of my scripts were optioned. And I cannot imagine writing a scene where I say, okay, she's going to take out her cell phone and she's going to text. And, it's so cheap. Really so lazy and so cheap. Something that I can't imagine her grandmother.
I know. She's probably spinning in her grave over some of that. Oh. I mean, there are some wonderful things on TV at the moment that I know that she would love. I mean, I don't know if you've seen the Extraordinary Attorney Wu on Netflix. I would recommend that to anybody. Yeah. That's a wonderful program.
But there's really very little when, I know I pronounced it, I think, the European way. I said Marlene Dietrich. But it's, of course, sort of Americans think Marlene Dietrich. So,
right.
You know, it's coming up. It's nearing the time, the anniversary of her passing. She passed away at the beginning of May. How many years ago now? Quite a few.
91.
In 91. Yeah. And first, I want to play a song for you. And then, so we'll sort of transition and talk a little bit about your grandmother and my dad.
Sure. Okay.
You do something for me.
You do something to me, something that simply mystifies. Tell me, why should it be? You have the power to hypnotize me. Let me live 'neath your spell. Do that voodoo that you do. So well, you do something to me that nobody else could do.
Oh, I just love it. You know, Peter, when I hear her voice, I think, of course, of my dad. Now, you know, she did over 500 shows in Europe during World War II. My dad got to see her, but it wasn't a planned show. She was just driving through on her Jeep, headed to one of the camps, and she stopped and just stood up at the back of the Jeep, stood up and took off her helmet, because she was wearing a helmet, because this was the war zone. It wasn't, you know, some movie set. This was a real war zone. And when my dad always described when she took off the helmet, he was in love with her.
Well, she was, at that time, she was part of Patton's army. She was traveling with them, and she escaped the Battle of the Bulge by like 6 hours. But the plane they got her out on was freezing cold, and she froze from the waist down, which much later on they found out that damaged the valve that splits the blood vessel to the legs, and DeBakey had to fix it much later on. But anyway, her cohorts in her performances in the European Theater of Operations, she and Danny Thomas were the troupe together, and they were absolutely hysterical together. And Danny Thomas, every time I had breakfast with him in L.A., he would say, your grandmother tried to get us killed every single day. If there was any daylight left, she'd load us all into the Jeep or the truck, and we'd go and find six guys in a foxhole, and we'd do the whole performance for six guys in a foxhole while the howitzers were flying overhead. But he was the same way. He was devoted to helping the soldiers and keeping the morale up so that they would prevail in this terrible war. And it was the happiest time of her life because she felt 100% useful for a purpose that she fervently believed in. She was a staunch anti-fascist, anti-Nazi, and anything that she could do, she wasn't a man, she wasn't a soldier with a gun, although she was given enough guns by generals to protect herself. Really, for her, it was about helping the soldiers that she always referred to as her boys. For the rest of her life, she called them her boys. And she would, in all her cabaret performances afterwards, she would say, "Are any of my boys here in the audience?" And men would raise their hands, and she would sing to them.
Yeah.
And she meant it. It was not... she and Bob Hope had a wonderful relationship. They never performed together or anything, but there was a time when Bob Hope was getting criticized for going to Vietnam and doing the USO tours in Vietnam for the troops. And she phoned journalists, she phoned naysayers, and told them off and said, no, what he's doing is exactly right. They need that lift. They need that hope that life will be normal when it's all over. And she believed in the USO. She was a great supporter of anything to do with the USO, to the point where my mother, of course, as soon as she was eligible in early 45, she joined up and she was in the USO as well, and she served in Italy and then Germany up until late 46. So it was a time of great pride for Marlena, and she never felt anything in her life was as worthwhile as the time she spent supporting her boys.
Well, it was, as you said, it was just before the Battle of the Bulge that my father got to see her, and there were eight guys on the side of the road, and he was one of them. those guys and some of them didn't make it through that battle, and so my dad was in love with her all of his life, and we watched if she was on in those days, the black and white movie was on television, the whole family would sit there so that he could recall that one moment of joy. You know, you didn't have many moments of joy in World War II, so that was, and his feet were frozen in the Battle of the Bulge, and
wow.
He suffered for the rest of his life. And the one gift that we always gave him, he didn't need ties, but we always got him the most expensive socks because his feet hurt for the rest of his life. So,
I'm sorry.
You know, your grandmother did a great thing, and she also, not just USO, she also did work for the OSS.
Well, that, you see, the OSS were smart. They became the CIA later, but at that time, the OSS was really intelligent. They knew they had to find people inside Germany who were anti-Nazi, and they needed to be able to get information from them all the way through the war. And the way they sort of recruited them was, if they talked to them, those people wouldn't say anything because they assumed it was the Gestapo pretending to be Americans. But when you get Marlena on the phone, you know that that's the real deal. So she made quite a few of those phone calls for the OSS, and then she recorded records for the OSS to play in the airwaves so that the civilian population in Germany and the soldiers who were listening to radio broadcasts would hear her sing and say, you know, the things that were... yes, propaganda at the time against the Nazi regime. And I think that was, to a large extent, effective in part of the battle the OSS felt for the hearts and minds of the people who were behind in Germany. You know, it's worth remembering that at the time, there were a lot of people who blindly followed the Nazi regime. And when they came to realize that was a mistake, they had nowhere to go. They had no hope of not being labeled as Nazis for the rest of their life. And hearing a voice of somebody who says, give it up, stop being a Nazi, find a new way forward. And indeed, even after Germany fell, Marlene used to make broadcasts in Germany to the German citizens saying, you were misled, you can rise above this, you can find a way forward. And she was a great support of the trials at Nuremberg, because the Nuremberg trials weren't so much to find people who are guilty or not guilty, it was to expose to the German population the truth of what the Nazi regime was all about. And in that process of learning, Germany was able to reconstruct its constitution and its way forward.
Well,
and in fact, in the constitution of Germany, a lot of people don't know this, in the constitution of Germany, it is a federal offense immediately sent to jail for anybody who supports, promotes, waves the flag of, or has anything to do with Nazi power.
Well, your grandmother was a remarkable woman in so many ways, not just as a great actress and coming out with the butterfly light that so many actresses have benefited from. Of course, she was a great beauty, highly intelligent, and I think she also loved to read, right?
Well, she was an avid reader. She loved novels, and she would devour at least once a day. One book a day, and we gave all the books that she had in her apartment in Paris to the American Embassy Library, and they were astounded. There were about 2,000 books that came to them. And she loved detective stories, and she loved adventure stories. She was an avid and voracious reader. I mean, for her, traveling or being without a book was an anathema. So, yeah, anytime there was a book available, she would read it. That's why Hemingway used to share all his first or second or third drafts with her as well, because he valued her opinion. And she was quite a critic at times.
Well, she was absolutely fantastic. I can't imagine what she'd think about this new war in Europe. You know, it's so strange to think that we have another war in Europe.
Well, here's the strange thing. My grandmother loved the Russian people. She thought that the Russian people were wonderful, stalwart, brave, and they believed in their country, in the land. And she would absolutely detest Putin before being the fascist that he is. She was a staunch Democrat in every sense of the word. I'm not talking about political party here. She believed in democracy. And it was one of the reasons Ronald Reagan and she got on so well. It's one of the reasons that she, when Gorbachev was put in house arrest, she phoned every world leader, king, queen, that she could talk to on the phone, and she talked to all of them, and got them to put pressure to get Gorbachev released. She believes in the right of individuals and people. I mean, a lot of people said to me, gosh, Peter, you know, but she was a German. I said, no, first of all, she was a Berliner. Berlin was the most open cultural city in the world for centuries. Secondly, she was an American and proud to be American. And she was the first female to get the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the first female ever to get it. And she has three rangs of the French Legion d'Honneur. She got the Leopold Medal from Belgium and from Israel and so on. She believed absolutely to her deepest core in the voice of the people being triumphant. And that's why she was happy to engage in opposition to the Nazi Party and support the Allied forces.
Well, Peter, I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. It's always a joy to talk to you. You just have to send me release dates for the authors that you want to come on Joy on Paper. I'd be happy to have them. And, of course,
wonderful.
I'm looking forward to having you back. You're going to have a release date in November, you said?
Yes, ma'am. I'll be happy to talk with you again, always, Patsy.
Okay. Well, and of course, I will continue to promote all of your books because they are just so wonderful. If you're looking for doing a book binge, just go and check out Peter Riva's site. He has a lovely website with some nice, great photos there. And it's just Peter Riva. You have everything you need there. You can find out more about his trips to Africa, about his series set in Africa. And Peter, I thank you so much for, you know, being a guest today. You are truly somebody who's, you know, for me, there are certain characters from books that are not characters. They're beyond characters to me. They're like friends. Jane Eyre is one. I can conjure her up at any moment of the day. And Mbuno is one.
When I
was sad during the pandemic, I would listen to him, and I was filled, actually, with courage. And
I'm so happy. That's so nice of you. You have no idea how happy you make me. Thank you so much.
Because sometimes characters, well, they really do jump out of books. And you created here a character, and I'm so glad that there are going to be more books in this series. So, again, thank you. I'm going to play another song of your grandmother's for you. And this one is one that I remember very well when I was young from an author, songwriter who wrote this song. But I think he sang it himself, but I think she sings it better. Okay, bye-bye now. But stay on and listen to this song.
Thank you, Pastor.
Here's a song by Pete Seeger, a song that I love very much. Where have all the flowers gone? Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing. Where have all the flowers gone? Long time ago. Where have all the flowers gone? Young girls pick them, everyone. When